Good evening, I'm Amna Nawaz. Jeff Bennett is away. On the NewsHour tonight, a federal judge rules that Google is a monopoly, a landmark decision that could ripple across big tech. Stocks plunge around the world on fears of a U.S. recession. A look at the data fueling investors' concerns. Hurricane Debbie batters Florida's coast and threatens inland flooding. And we speak with voters in the swing state of Georgia about Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign and the issues driving this election. Welcome to the NewsHour. In a landmark ruling, a federal judge has found that tech giant Google broke antitrust laws, acting illegally to maintain a monopoly in online search. Google currently controls roughly 90% of the world's internet searches. Today's ruling could upend how Americans get their information online and fundamentally change the way that big tech companies operate. To help explain what this all means, I'm joined now by Rebecca Allensworth, a professor at Vanderbilt Law School. So, Professor, just put this into context for us. How big a deal is today's ruling?
It's a really big deal. The Biden administration has five major monopolization cases going right now against Google, Meta, Amazon, and Apple. This is the first one to go to trial, and they won. So in a sense, they're one for one.
So when we take a step back here, we see the DOJ and states had sued Google a few years ago, accusing it of illegally securing this online search dominance we just noted, in part by paying companies like Apple and Samsung to make sure Google was the default search engine on their devices. Do they have to change that practice as part of the remedy here? I mean, what changes with this ruling?
Well, the judge didn't say anything about a remedy yet. That's going to be the next round of litigation, and we can expect both sides to fight hard over that. But yes, very likely there will be a remedy that changes the way that we engage with search on our phones and on our devices. And it's hard to overstate what a big deal this is. You know, the Biden administration has been trying in lots of different ways to come after competition in the big tech sector, which it feels like is flagging. And this is a real sign that antitrust is up for the task. It's not stuck in the smokestack industries. And depending on how the remedy comes out, this could be a really, really big turning point in how we think about competition for big tech.
And are there broader implications here for big tech in terms of how they're currently operating? Will any of that change as a result of this ruling?
I think it will. I mean, this case, of course, only applies to Google, and we still have to see the remedy and then, of course, appeals. But there's all kinds of, I would call them breadcrumbs in the opinion that other litigants could take up in other cases against tech. Lots of holdings here that are relevant to the cases that I mentioned before, but also any other challenges that you might have to how tech is competing. I would be very concerned if I were thinking about how the competitive landscape is going to look in the future. If I were a tech company, I might not have the monopoly and the dominance that I've enjoyed for the last, 10 or 20 years. That's not going to be as secure after this case comes out.
What are some of those breadcrumbs, as you put it? What stood out to you about the details of the judge's ruling today?
Well, first of all, he said that, this is a zero price market. Consumers don't pay for search. And yet that is not something that is a defense that, zero price markets can be monopolized. Defining a market is a little bit difficult in a zero price context. He doesn't have any problem defining a market here. So I think a lot of the tools that the tech companies have been trying to use to combat other tech companies in other cases have been trying to combat their problems are becoming a lot more suspect after this case is on the books.
So you mentioned no remedy decided just yet, but should users of Google expect any kind of difference in how they interact with the search right now?
Not in the short term. I think the remedy will be months, if not years away. And I do think that there's likely to be a difference in the way that we engage with Google ultimately, but not in the short term. The big thing here is just the precedence that it sets for both Google, but also the rest of the tech companies in going forward and what they can and can't do. What the rules of the road in big tech are is changed by this case.
When you take a step back on that note, the last big antitrust ruling against a tech company was more than 20 years ago against Microsoft. We're in an entirely new internet age right now. So when you look at this ruling in that context, what does it say to you about the government's potential role when it comes to regulating tech companies?
Well, the government has always had a major role in regulating competition. That goes back to the Sherman Act from 1890. What's really unusual is how it has abdicated that role over the last 20 years. And I think this is a turning point in that story. I think that this does say that the government has an important role to play, even in emerging and networked tech industries.
That is Vanderbilt Law School's Professor Rebecca Allensworth joining us tonight on this landmark Google ruling. Professor, thank you. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And in other major business news, global markets started the week in a tailspin amid concerns that the U.S. economy could be sliding towards a recession. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average had its worst day in nearly 2 years, dropping more than 1,000 points. The Nasdaq lost more than 500 points on the day. The S&P 500 dropped 160 points, or exactly 3%. Globally, the Japanese stock market dropped more than 12%, its biggest percentage drop since the late 1980s, while sell-offs spread to other markets in Asia and Europe, which are facing slowdowns of their own. To discuss what this means, I'm joined now by David Wessel. He's director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution. David, welcome back. Good to see you. So why that sudden plunge in global markets overnight? What was fueling that?
Well, it's always hard to say why the mood shifted, and when it does, why everybody seems to go in the same direction at once. But there are a couple of things we know. One is, a lot of people, a lot of big firms apparently have borrowed money in Japan at 0% interest rates and invested that outside of Japan. Japan surprised people by beginning to raise interest rates last week, and a lot of those people seem to have been caught short and had to sell stuff. And when they all sell at once, you see what happens. But as you mentioned, also the recent signals about the U.S. economy have been a bit discouraging. The jobs market report last Friday shows some weakening. Corporate earnings have been signaling that demand is slowing. So I think those two things combined, why it happens today, who knows? And then the backdrop is that the prospect of wider war in the Middle East can't help people's spirits and make them more confident about the future.
And that those data points you mentioned, the weaker than expected jobs report in July, also unemployment rate jumping to 4.3%, triggered fears of a potential U.S. recession, as we noted. Are those fears overblown or are they justified right now?
I think the odds of a recession have gone up, but I still don't think it's the most likely outcome. It's very easy to get freaked out when the market does something like it did today and say, what do they know? And is the end of the recovery at hand? But the economy has still been pretty strong. Employers still have been hiring. And I don't think that there are signs of a recession yet. The question is the economy slowing more quickly than the Fed expected? And is the Fed behind the curve? They didn't raise interest rates at their meeting last week. And a lot of people think now that was a mistake.
When you look at the impact on the tech markets in particular, they were some of the worst performers on the day today. NVIDIA fell over 5%. Apple took a hit after Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway sold off half of its Apple stock. What's going on in the tech industry in particular, and why are they hurting the most?
Well, they're hurting the most, but remember, they had a huge climb. So you mentioned NVIDIA. NVIDIA's stock, they make these fancy semiconductor chips used in AI. It's down 20% in the past month, but it's still more than double what it was a year ago. The Meta, the Facebook, lost 12% last month. It's up 50% over the last year. A couple of things are going on. One is they got the tech bubble, it seems like a bubble, got a little bit out of hand. So they climbed a mountain. The stock prices have now come down the mountain, but they're not back to where they were. Secondly, there's a little less euphoria about the immediate benefits of AI. I think people thought it was going to change everything right away, and the companies that are in that business were going to just be printing money. And now people have gotten a little more realistic.
David, in about 30 seconds I have left, everyday investors who look at this and are worried about their retirement savings or other investments, should they do anything right now?
I think the right thing to do now is nothing. A day like this is absolutely the worst time to make big decisions to buy or sell. But it is a reminder that the stock market goes up and the stock market goes down. So people who are in retirement or saving for a house or expect to send their kids to college in the next year or two, it's not a good idea to have all your savings in stocks.
David Wessel of the Hutchins Center at the Brookings Institution. David, always good to see you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We begin the day's other headlines in Bangladesh, where the prime minister has resigned and fled the country after weeks of violent demonstrations. Sheikh Hasina had been in power since 2009 and was the country's longest-serving leader. Her departure comes after peaceful student protests against job quotas escalated into nationwide unrest that's left nearly 300 people dead since mid-July. Today, thousands of demonstrators stormed the prime minister's official residence in the capital city of Dhaka. Meanwhile, in Washington, the State Department offered condolences for the lives lost and pushed for an orderly transition.
It is vital that we have full and transparent investigations to ensure accountability for these deaths. What we want to see is democratic order. We want to see the Bangladeshi people choose their own government, and that's what we'll be looking for in the days and weeks ahead.
The country's military chief says he's taking temporary control as soldiers try to calm the unrest. Bangladesh's figurehead president, Mohammed Shahabuddin, announced today that parliament will be dissolved and a new government will be formed as soon as possible. To the Middle East now, a Department of Defense spokesperson has confirmed to the NewsHour that several U.S. personnel were injured in a suspected rocket attack at the Al-Asad military base in Iraq. It's the second such strike on the facility in less than a month, and it comes amid heightened tensions in the region. Also today, Hezbollah launched a new drone attack on northern Israel, leaving two Israeli soldiers injured. That follows last week's killings by Israel of a senior Hezbollah commander in Lebanon and a top Hamas leader in Iran. In Tehran today, officials said that last week's targeted killing on Iranian soil won't go unanswered.
The Islamic Republic of Iran will definitely take serious deterrent actions to guarantee its security and punish the aggressor with power, decisiveness, and toughness.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke by phone to several of his Middle Eastern counterparts today, encouraging them to tell Iran that escalation is not in their interest. Meanwhile, the United Nations says it has fired nine staffers from its Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA. That comes after an internal investigation found they may have been involved in Hamas's October attack against Israel. Allegations of such involvement led more than a dozen countries to pause funding to UNRWA, including the United States. Most have since resumed doing so, though the U.S. has not. The Supreme Court rejected an attempt to delay Donald Trump's sentencing in his New York hush money trial until after the November election. The decision also left in place a gag order on the former president. The state of Missouri had filed the lawsuit claiming that the New York case infringed on the rights of voters, quote, to hear from and vote for their preferred presidential candidate. In May, a jury found Trump guilty of 34 counts of falsifying business records. His sentencing is scheduled for September. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas failed to disclose more trips on a private jet provided by GOP donor Harlan Crow in 2010. That's according to a letter from Senator Ron Wyden to Mr. Crow. The Oregon Democrat wrote, quote, I am deeply concerned that Mr. Crow may have been showering a public official with extravagant gifts, then writing off those gifts to lower his tax bill. The letter is part of an inquiry into the relationship between the two men and comes amid a broader push to clamp down on Supreme Court ethics rules. A spokesman for Harlan Crow said the inquiries have no legal basis. Pope Francis has named a new leader of the Catholic Church in Boston after accepting the resignation of the city's longtime archbishop. Sean O'Malley, who's 80 years old, took the helm at the height of the clergy sexual abuse scandal in 2003. Since then, he's been a key advisor to the Pope and a leading Vatican official on the protection of minors. At a press conference today, he expressed optimism about passing the torch to Richard Henning, who's been serving as the Bishop of Providence, Rhode Island.
When I arrived, it was at a time of great crisis and great pain because of the terrible scourge of sexual abuse. But despite all of the challenges that we have, I am filled with hope.
The Archdiocese of Boston serves nearly 2 million Catholics, making it one of the largest in the country. And we have more results and a few spoilers from the Summer Olympics. On the last day of gymnastics, Simone Biles bid adieu to Paris during today's floor exercise final. She secured a silver medal, while a last-minute score inquiry boosted her teammate, Jordan Chiles, to bronze. In a display of sportsmanship, Biles and Chiles bowed to the Brazilian, Rebeca Andrade, for her golden moment. Meanwhile, the U.S. won silver in the mixed relay triathlon after the River Seine was deemed safe to swim in once again. So looking at the evening's medal count, Team USA maintains a healthy lead over China with 78 medals overall. Still to come on the NewsHour, anti-immigrant protesters wreak havoc in England. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter weigh in on the Democratic vice presidential pick. We report from a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon where Hamas has been gaining popularity. And decorated Olympian Allison Felix discusses efforts to support athletes with children.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Hurricane Debby barreled into northern Florida this morning with Category 1 winds. The state has reported at least four deaths so far. Now a tropical storm, it's slowly moving inland, expected to hit Georgia and the Carolinas later this week. Its gusty winds are packing a punch with hundreds of thousands of power outages reported. But authorities are most concerned about Debby's rainfall, which is expected to be historic. William Brangham has our report.
Debby lashed Florida's Big Bend today with fierce winds, powerful storm surges, and torrential downpours. The rain triggered catastrophic flooding, submerging whole neighborhoods and stranding drivers.
Well, good morning. I'm here.
Governor Ron DeSantis was out early today with a warning.
The most important thing to do is to just protect yourself and protect your family. Don't go out into this storm. Don't drive on the roads, particularly when they're flooded.
Shortly after, authorities pulled a semi-truck out of the water in Tampa after it fell over a guardrail, killing the driver. Yesterday, in fierce winds, the U.S. Coast Guard had to pull two people out of the Gulf of Mexico after their sailboat was damaged. On land, wind whipped Florida's western peninsula as Debby slowly crept along offshore.
It was actually like pushing me. Like literally I was outside in a storm that was actually pushing me.
Tampa's usually packed Bayshore Boulevard was a ghost town as waves crashed onto the sidewalk. County sheriffs patrolled the streets of Fort Myers Beach, also inundated by rain and storm surge.
It's really treacherous out.
There were similar scenes across Florida's southwestern coast.
In terms of rainfall, this is becoming a worst-case scenario because Debby has made its way parallel to the Florida coast.
Jeff Berardelli is chief meteorologist for WFLA-TV in Tampa.
And that means rain falling over and over and over again over the same areas. And that means we could see 2.5 feet of rain in some places. And there's no place in the country that can handle that much rain in that period of time. There is going to be some dangerous and maybe catastrophic flooding in the southeast.
As Debby continues to churn north, residents of Georgia and the Carolinas are preparing for those potentially historic rainfall totals.
That will be a generational storm that we've not seen. They're calling it a 500 to 1,000 year storm. And so with that, we're extremely concerned about flooding.
Berardelli says repeated disasters like this, events that are made worse by climate change, are stretching the nation's ability to respond.
What concerns me is this is yet again another billion-dollar disaster in the making. And, you know, we can only handle so many of these before people become wary, before we exhaust our resources. It's really hard to help the amount of people being affected by these big extreme weather events, and it's really starting to wear on us.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who's been in office just a month, has promised to crack down on groups of what he called right-wing thugs, who've ignited a week of racist, anti-immigrant riots in towns and cities across England. Nearly 400 people have been arrested in the past few days, and more arrests are expected. From England, special correspondent Malcolm Brabant reports.
These are just some of the social media videos that detectives are trawling through to identify and prosecute perpetrators participating in and stoking Britain's worst riots since 2011.
They're in there.
After days of unrest, the crisis deteriorated over the weekend when a mob attacked a hotel housing asylum seekers in the northern city of Rotherham. The government minister responsible for law and order is Home Secretary Yvette Cooper.
It's a total disgrace, and there has to be a reckoning. Those individuals who are involved in the disorder need to know that they will pay a price.
After forcing police to retreat, some of the mob tried to set fire to the hotel, full of people of colour. Prime Minister Keir Starmer.
If you target people because of the colour of their skin or their faith, then that is far right, and I'm prepared to say so.
Tats are awesome, man. Pure British. Yes, mate.
The man with the Nazi swastika tattoo replied that he was a true Englishman amid an expletive-filled rant against foreigners. Inaccurate social media posts triggered violence across the country last week after these three girls were stabbed to death at a dance class in Southport in northwest England. 17-year-old Axel Rudakubana, a British-born son of Rwandan parents with a history of autism, has been charged with 3 counts of murder and 10 of attempted murder. The supposed motive for the riots has now pivoted to anger over the impact of mass immigration. Keir Starmer again.
This is violence. It is not protest. It doesn't matter what the motivation is. The motivation for the vast majority of people in this country is to see their streets safe.
Big problem, yeah.
As asylum seekers cowered inside the wrecked hotel in Rotherham, 70 miles to the south, in the city of Tamworth, a similar migrant shelter came under attack from would-be arsonists.
There will be people who were thinking they were going on their summer holidays this week, and instead they will face a knock on the door from the police. They will face arrest and a prison cell.
Police, open the door!
So far, there have been hundreds of arrests. But there are warnings that the government may struggle to deliver swift justice.
The situation in the criminal justice system in England and Wales is really dire at the moment.
Cassia Rowland is a criminal justice specialist with Britain's Institute of Government.
We are out of prison capacity. We're already releasing people early. We've got major backlogs in the courts. So I think it is a really difficult thing for them to do, to try and fast track that in that way.
Britain's 4 million strong Muslim community is concerned about being targeted by the mobs. In some cities, young Muslim men have turned out in force to counter-protest. In an attempt to head off racial clashes, the government has pledged to protect the nation's 1,500 mosques. But is it enough?
If the police can't cope, then maybe you need to look at the other option of bringing the army in. That's not going to be a great look for the United Kingdom, and I don't want that to happen. But ultimately, we've got to maintain law and order. You cannot have anarchy on our streets.
Shafak Mohammed is a former member of the European Parliament and a councillor for a district next to Rotherham.
Do you think social cohesion in Britain is breaking down?
What I don't want is for people to live parallel lives where we never talk to each other, we never interact with each other. And that's what fosters, you know, mistrust between different communities.
Apparently unperturbed by the government crackdown, one right-wing channel on the Telegram messaging service is trying to coordinate attacks against pro-immigration lawyers and other asylum centres. Restoring public order has become the new Labour government's most serious challenge. At stake is Britain's future as a cohesive, multicultural society. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant.
It's official. Today marked the final round of online balloting by Democratic delegates, making Vice President Kamala Harris the first Black and South Asian woman to ever secure the presidential nomination from one of America's two major political parties. Laura Barrón-López recently traveled to Georgia to hear from Black women, a pivotal voting bloc for the Democratic Party, about Harris's candidacy and this milestone.
Kamala Harris's first major rally in the key state of Georgia since she began her campaign for president. The atmosphere was more like a concert than a political event. Reflecting a surge in enthusiasm among Democratic voters since Harris announced her candidacy just over 2 weeks ago.
I do think this has energized us for the future, looking forward.
To me, this is more than just a campaign. It's the future. I have a 25-year-old. My daughter just turned 25 in June. And when you hear people talking about taking people's voting rights away, telling women what to do with their bodies, I really hate that we're going backwards.
Voters of color, and especially Black women, helped flip Georgia blue in 2020. 95% of Black women in the state backed Joe Biden, and will be critical to any path to victory here for Harris. To get a deeper look at what this historic moment means and the issues that matter most to this voting bloc, I sat down with three Black women from the Peach State.
What was your reaction when you saw the party rally so quickly behind Vice President Harris?
I was super excited because finally we had someone on the ticket that looked like me and was living proof that it can be done. And at that moment, I was like, whatever I need to do to support her, I will do it.
My heart leapt. My heart leapt. The phrase that keeps coming to mind is, let's go. Let's go, President Harris. Let's get it. And I'm saying President Harris purposefully.
It was this monumental energy shift. You know, people are talking about it on every social media platform. You can't go in the coffee shop and not hear about what's going on.
It's an excitement these women haven't felt since President Obama's 2008 campaign.
I feel that this exceeds that.
This feels even more elevated, more excitement, and more just a general, like, a big sigh of relief. And then this huge surge of energy. It's 2008 plus a whole, like, 100 times more.
One thing that immediately caught a lot of Gen Z voters off rip was her joy.
22-year-old Kayla Pouncey, who grew up in Atlanta, says the vice president formed a unique connection to her generation during Harris's first run for president in 2020.
That's kind of been an ongoing meme, just kind of the idea of laughing in the face of chaos and not only going into the room with positivity, but taking the energy in the room and changing it.
For Maya Edie McCarthy, a doctor who herself experienced pregnancy complications in 2020, the vice president's outspoken advocacy for reproductive rights since the fall of Roe v. Wade stands out.
I want to be able to leave this world and know that my daughter has more freedoms than I was able to enjoy, not less. And I firmly believe that no man, no government should inform what I choose to do about my body, especially when it comes to reproductive health.
Mother of four, Rachel Mitchum Elahi, says voters will also be focused on the economy this cycle.
I'm hearing concerns about financial security and not only how are we living day to day now, how are we going to make it with rising prices, but also concern about Social Security.
Pouncey says many Gen Z voters hope that Harris will distance herself from Biden's approach to the Israel-Hamas war.
We want to see some sort of statement taking a bold stance and action that will ultimately result in a ceasefire from the vice president.
If she doesn't take that bold stance, do you still plan on voting for her?
I do plan on still voting for her. A step in that direction would be significantly better than ultimately, you know, settling for the alternative.
That alternative, former President Donald Trump, recently stepped up personal attacks against Harris, including questioning her Black identity during an interview before the National Association of Black Journalists.
She was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was Black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn Black, and now she wants to be known as Black.
We spoke to these women before Trump's comments. But in follow-up conversations, all the women agreed that Trump's statements were offensive.
is just, it's senseless. It's disrespectful. As a biracial woman, she decides what she identifies with. It's not like she, quote unquote, turned a certain race or ethnicity at a certain period in life. She's always been that way.
It was a slap in the face. She has always shown up as an African-American or African-American and Asian woman.
And it's because of that identity, they say, that Harris has faced a unique set of critiques.
Some Republicans have called her a DEI hire. What do you make of all of those attacks?
It's very important for us to question what those things mean, because ultimately you're saying that she's unqualified because she's Black, and that because she is a Black woman and that she fulfills that status, she will not be able to handle the responsibilities of the job.
I'm not even sure why I'm giving oxygen to these schoolyard antics. That being said, there's an adage in our community that we have to work twice as hard to get half as far. But when we get in position, we still must perform. And she is more than capable.
In the past, we've seen sexist, racist remarks made against candidates like Barack Obama, made against Hillary Clinton when she ran. Are you concerned at all just about the road that Vice President Harris faces?
I'm more so concerned about the mental health of a lot of young Black girls in our nation who are watching these things happen. You finally get to see somebody who looks like you up on this platform ready to make change, and then just to see the world so viciously tear at her and try to break that spirit is very detrimental.
Despite these attacks, this group says America is ready to elect its first Black woman president.
I'd never thought I'd see something like this in my lifetime. Women can adequately lead this country, more than adequately lead this country, and it is time to put a woman on that platform to get the job done.
Change is scary, and it's hard to envision it sometimes. Whether people think we're ready for something or not, it shouldn't preclude you or stop you from launching out. Even though people didn't think they were ready for this, we are. We're ready. We're ready.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Laura Barone Lopez in Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, the 2024 race for the White House has been upended in the last few weeks, even as we wait for the next big decision, the announcement of Kamala Harris's running mate. For a look at the race, we turn now to our Politics Monday team. That is Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. Great to see you both.
Hello.
Thank you.
So we know Vice President Harris is expected to appear with her running mate tomorrow night. We don't yet know who that will be, but we will know by then. As you both know, the top contenders are reportedly these three men: Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, and Arizona Senator Mark Kelly. That announcement is going to come in this context, though. When you take a look at the latest CBS News polling, it shows essentially a statistical tie nationally and in battleground states between Vice President Harris and former President Trump. You see those numbers there. So, Amy, when you look at those numbers and who she's considering, could the vice presidential pick move those numbers, have an impact on the race?
Right. I mean, I think it's unlikely that it does much. The vice president, we talk a lot about the vice presidential pick. It's an important moment, especially for a new candidate. I know she's not new. She's been the vice president, but we haven't seen her as a presidential nominee. So this will be her very first executive action. How does she make this decision, I think, becomes important. The second thing it allows her to do is to have another good week if everything goes right, if the rollout goes well. This is the do no harm theory of the case with a pick, and that she is able to own another week of the media coverage, and then that transitions directly into the DNC. So that would be 3 weeks of the Harris campaign being able to set the terms of the debate and the narrative, where what she has to choose between of those three, it seems like. Progressives are very, very much pushing for the governor of Minnesota, mm-hmm. Tim Walz. The more progressive, moderate wing of the Democratic Party is saying, you got to go with somebody like Shapiro, who will help to set the narrative for you. If the case that the Trump campaign is making is Kamala Harris is too liberal, getting somebody who isn't the choice of progressives is a way to get those swing voters.
Well, Tam, let's take a look at those three top contenders once more, guys. Let's put that graphic up for just a moment here. When you look at these men, Tam, what would each of them bring to a potential Harris ticket? I mean, what does it show that she is prioritizing in her pick here?
What our reporting tells us is that she is prioritizing having someone on her team who would be a governing partner, someone who she can work with, someone who she has chemistry with. None of these are people who she has long-standing relationships with. So she is, as Amy said, and as I said last week, looking for someone who will do no harm, who will be safe, and in theory will be somebody who can get out and campaign and drive a message. And what we've seen over the last week is sort of the virtual audition of all three of these men going out and doing cable hits. Tim Walz, in some ways, I guess, wins the cable audition because he has used this term weird to describe J.D. Vance and former President Trump, and it has stuck. Mm-hmm. And now everyone is calling them weird, and then they are responding saying, no, I'm not weird, you're weird. And people are giving Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota, former congressman, credit for that.
Amy, I want to return to the polls and what they tell us for just a moment here, because the race is still tied, even as the ticket has changed. You saw this surge in financial support for Harris after she moved to the top of the ticket. The campaign's fundraising for July showed Harris campaign now has over $300 million. Trump campaign now has about $140 million. But we didn't necessarily see a similar surge in polling. Does that surprise you?
Well, can I make an argument?
Please do. Which is why I put it to you.
Which is, you know, in this day and age, in our very calcified, polarized era, a surge is moving a race from one where Trump was up by three to one where Harris is now up, let's say, at one point or tied. Mm-hmm. That's a four-point shift in 2 weeks. That's a big, big deal, and that matters a lot. So I think what we've seen now is the race has shifted from one where Trump was ahead and it was his race to lose to one where, oh, this race is actually really a toss-up now. Now, where it isn't is where we were in 2020 at this time, where Biden was up, you know, in the polling at least, by 8 points or something, and he ended up winning by four. So this is much closer than it was in 2020, but a heck of a lot better than where we were. The other thing about the money I think that's important is that Democrats have had a money lead for a long time, and they've spent it on Biden and didn't do anything. So now Harris and her campaign have an opportunity to, in many ways, say the same things, although it's different. She gets to be sort of a change candidate that Biden wasn't. But you can see what she talks about in her very first ad. She's a prosecutor. Trump's taking us backward. We're never going back. And to Tam's point about what you want for a VP, I think the candidate that can also deliver that message with her and sound credible is going to be really important.
Tim, I want to ask you about what we're hearing about the Harris campaign from the Trump-Vance campaign. Mm-hmm. They were campaigning in Georgia this past week, and it feels like they are struggling to coalesce around a strategy around her. We've seen Republicans like Senator Lindsey Graham say, focus on her record and what she did not do. Mr. Trump goes off script, veers into racist questioning of her racial and ethnic identity. What's the impact of that? I mean, is there a strategy to combat the ticket?
And is that really off script, or is that where this was going all along? And I guess we'll never know for sure, but the cycle of people saying, oh, Trump, don't tweet so much. Oh, Trump, just watch your mouth and everything will be great. His supporters have said that every day that he has been on the political scene. So I think that they really are, though, in the throwing spaghetti at the wall phase of this and trying to figure out what actually sticks to Harris. They've tried San Francisco liberal. I assume they will try a lot more of that in the days and weeks to come. They have tried to say that she was too tough a prosecutor, not tough enough of a prosecutor, that she is a chameleon, that she doesn't know her racial identity, that she's different, a different person to different people. Trump has tried various things from crazy to low IQ, a lot of it sort of shrouded in familiar tropes for female candidates and for candidates of color in this country. What sticks? Who knows? But they are trying different messages. You know, he spent a big part of his rally on Saturday complaining about the crowd size, complaining that he wasn't allowed to have as many people into the arena that was the same arena where she had an event days earlier, complaining about the crowd size, then, you know, complaining that she had a rapper. And so really that wasn't it isn't representative. See, they were there for the rapper, not for her. So he's really trying everything.
Yeah.
eventually they'll coalesce around something.
Before I let you go, Emmy, I have to ask you, because you talk so much about it, about the impact of a third party candidate right now. Yeah. RFK Jr. was polling in double digits at one point. Latest CBS News poll says he's showing it polling rather at 2%. And there's been a series of weird headlines, yes, is the only way to put it. The brain, yes, worm, the dead bear cub in, yes, Central Park. Is there still an impact he could have on this election?
Sure. I mean, in these battleground states that are going to be decided by 2 or 3 points, absolutely, he can siphon some votes away. What's interesting is his drop is also coinciding with Harris's rise. So I think there were a bunch of people sitting in, parked in the campaign of RFK Jr., who were never Trump voters, but were interested in basically sending a message saying, I'm not going to vote for Trump. I'm not really happy about Biden. Also, let's be clear, besides the headlines, RFK Jr. hasn't really done anything. He hasn't run any ads. He hasn't done campaigning. So it's not that surprising to see his drop.
Amy Walter, Tamara Keith, always great to see you both. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The killing of a top Hamas leader last week shook a Middle East already scarred by a war that the militant group launched last October 7th. The past 10 bloody months have also galvanized Palestinian populations beyond Gaza and the West Bank, especially in Lebanon. Factions of Hamas have also made it home, and special correspondent Simona Fultin recently gained rare access to its operations there for this report.
A show of defiance in the Lebanese city of Sur after Israel's killing in Tehran of Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh.
The resistance remains strong and will continue. This resistance will continue until the removal of this Israeli occupation and the complete defeat of the occupation from the entire Palestinian national territory.
Rallies in support of Hamas have been taking place across southern Lebanon since the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. The message is that his demise will not weaken Hamas, nor will it lessen its struggle for Palestinian liberation.
A liberation these men and women have awaited for decades. They are refugees, descendants of Palestinians expelled in 1948 when Israel was created. Rayan is 22 years old. She never set foot on Palestinian land, but is no less attached to the cause.
Since our childhood, Haniyeh has influenced us a lot. All our leaders, not just Haniyeh, have taught us that we should hold on to the resistance, no matter what the enemy does.
Hamas's October 7th attack on southern Israel was denounced as terrorism by the United States and other Western nations. But here it sparked a different sentiment, something Palestinians hadn't felt in decades, hope.
From when I was little, we have had the hope of returning and living in our homeland, and God willing, this day will come.
I want to know if this is a broader trend among the Palestinian diaspora in Lebanon and travel to Saida, home to the largest Palestinian refugee camp. Past the checkpoint of the Lebanese army, it feels as if we've crossed into another country. The camp is called Ain al-Helwe. Around 120,000 people live here in perpetual exile, crammed into less than half a square mile, a pressure cooker with poor services, few jobs, and no prospects. Now that frustration has found an outlet. I'm meeting a Hamas fighter who requested anonymity because he spoke outside the chain of command.
Do you think that since October 7th there is greater support for armed resistance?
Yes, of course there was support before, but not as much as we are seeing now. There was a general mobilization a month after the events of October 7th. Pretty much all the youth in this camp signed up to join Hamas.
Rising support for the resistance is visible in plain sight. The camp is run by Fatah, which was co-founded by Yasser Arafat and has led the Palestinian Authority since its creation. But Hamas has been gaining ground here, chipping away at Fatah's status as the guardian of the Palestinian cause, its green colors gradually usurping Fatah's yellow.
The green flag of Hamas and other symbols, like these posters of its military spokesperson Abu Obeida, have spread throughout the camp since October 7th, signaling growing support for armed resistance, even in areas that were not traditionally dominated by Hamas.
Fatah has been losing legitimacy for years now amid accusations of rampant corruption and its failure to achieve Palestinian statehood in the wake of the 1993 Oslo Accords, as part of which it renounced violence in return for recognition and the nominal authority to govern. But some within Fatah never laid down arms, like Munir Magdah, the most senior Fatah military official in the camp.
We participate in daily military action inside the West Bank in the face of Israeli occupation.
Magdah is a leader in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, a branch of Fatah founded during the second Palestinian uprising of the early 2000s. He points to Israel's continued occupation and settlement of Palestinian land in the West Bank as evidence that the Oslo Accords have failed.
Negotiations have been tried for 30 years and will not give the Palestinian people anything. The Palestinian people have no choice but to take their rights by force and blood. Today it's blood for blood until we get rid of this occupation in the land of Palestine.
Words that are finding fertile ground among disenfranchised Palestinian youth. But mobilization inside the camp is a delicate matter. It risks drawing Israeli airstrikes and alienating the Lebanese government, which sees it as a violation of its sovereignty. To get a glimpse into the secretive recruitment process, I visit a mosque in a neighborhood that is a Hamas stronghold. Hassan Shana, a local Hamas official, tells me that hundreds of young men have approached him since October, ready to take up arms against Israel, what they call the Zionist entity.
There's a large number of young people who want to join the movement to fight. Not to enter the movement and go through the recruitment process. No, they wanted us to give them weapons and go to Palestine through southern Lebanon so they can fight the Zionist entity.
The selection process can span years, with new recruits vetted at multiple stages. Religious instruction is at the very core of joining Hamas, which, unlike the more secular Fatah, is an Islamist movement.
First of all, he has to be committed and pray and take lessons with us. If his foundations and goals are where they should be, he will go out to the second stage and maybe take a special lesson.
The next stage is military training, which is where it gets more complicated. Hamas doesn't enjoy Fatah's status as the security provider in the camps and isn't officially allowed to maintain an armed presence inside Lebanon. But I met one new joiner who took part in covert training exercises, which take place in coordination with Hamas's ally, Lebanese paramilitary group Hezbollah.
They teach us about weapons, how to take them apart and put them together, about bombs, these kinds of things.
And this training is inside the camp or outside?
No, we go out and come back. I went out 2-3 times and came back.
Have a lot of your friends joined Hamas?
There are many, a lot. All were encouraged after October 7th.
Hamas is trying to capitalize on the youth's newfound zeal to obtain with force what hasn't been achieved with words. For Hassan Shana, the death and destruction in Gaza are a price worth paying.
The Zionist entity and the American administration were betting that adults here would die and children would forget. We say to the whole world, despite the tragedy, the massacres, the killing and the destruction, there's no alternative homeland to Palestine except Palestine.
Haniyeh's assassination has, for now, dashed hopes for a ceasefire. Many here see armed struggle as the only way forward. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Simona Foltin in Ain al-Helwa, Lebanon.
As Team USA continues to dominate at the Summer Olympics, the most decorated American athlete in track and field history, Allyson Felix, with 11 Olympic medals and 20 world championships to her name, is also in Paris, but with a different goal in mind, to change the narrative around mothers competing at the highest level. Allyson Felix joins us from Paris now. Allyson, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about this effort. You partnered with Pampers to basically create a nursery in the athletes' village for the Paris Games for athletes with young kids. It's the first ever Olympic facility of its kind. Why create this space? Why is it needed?
Yeah, when I came back from competition after having my daughter, it was really challenging and I had a hard time, you know, traveling around with her and competing. And so when I was appointed on the Athletes Commission of the IOC, it was really top of mind to figure out how can we better support mothers. And when we thought about the Olympic Games, it felt like this is something that should have been done a long time ago. And we're just so proud that now there's a space in the athlete village to be able to bring your babies, your young children, to spend time with them, bond with them, and also just get away from the pressures of the Olympic Games.
Tell me about that time when you came back after you had your first daughter in 2018. You competed in Tokyo in 2021 after that. With a young child, what was hard about that? What were the challenges?
Yeah, when I went, you know, back to competition, it was, you know, flying with an infant. It was, you know, going to competitions, sometimes being assigned a roommate or, you know, having to wash bottles in a hotel room. So just some of the like smaller practical things that were challenging. And so we just want to figure out a way, you know, how can we show up and how can we support mothers to make it easier so that they can know they are just as capable to have these big time performances after childbirth.
You mentioned this is the first ever facility of its kind. Why did it take so long?
I really think maybe a lack of having mothers at the table. And I think there's a lot of people who have paved the way for something like this to happen, pieces in place. And finally, it came around. I was shocked that, you know, when I brought it up before the commission, it was so well received and we moved really quickly on it. But I think sometimes we just need more voices, you know, more stories amplified. And I think now more than ever, we're seeing so many athlete mothers competing and doing so well that we are really trying to shift the culture.
And you have been one of those leading voices when it comes to calling for that support that you know mothers need. And you quoted someone else saying that basically having a baby in track and field was once called the kiss of death, meaning that your competing career was over. You have two children of your own now, but you very bravely called out your then sponsor of Nike back in 2019 for their maternity policy. You wrote an op-ed at the time, quote, "If we have children, we risk pay cuts from our sponsors during pregnancy and afterward. It's one example of a sports industry where the rules are still mostly made for and by men." Allison, you basically forced Nike to rewrite their maternity policy. But at the time, how hard was it to come out and say what you did?
Yeah, it was terrifying. I mean, for me, I'm a person who I don't really like to rock the boat. I'm haven't been in the past very outspoken. And it was just going through this very real life situation that I realized, you know, I have to say something. I had a traumatic birth experience with my daughter and it happened over the same course of this time. And I felt like that gave me that last bit of courage and that last push that I needed to say, there's no way I'm going to allow my daughter and her generation to take on this same fight. I really wanted to stand up for myself and other female athletes.
And that traumatic birth experience with your daughter, you've also talked about you had severe preeclampsia, which we know is a condition that puts Black women in particular at 5 times a higher risk of death than white women in America. I also want to note you were just awarded some $20 million by Melinda French Gates, a philanthropist, in a maternal health grant. What do you want to do with that? What are your plans for those funds?
Yeah, I was so humbled to be selected, you know, as a leader to be able to deploy these funds. And I really want to focus on Black maternal health. Of course, we're under the umbrella of women's health. And I really want to, you know, find organizations that are doing important and urgent work and have an impact really on the communities and the people who are most at risk. So I'm so excited to put these funds to use and to identify these organizations who will really be game changers.
So you're at these games as a spectator. We all just saw Noah Lyles win gold in the 100 meters. Sha'Carri Richardson takes silver. What have been some of your favorite moments so far?
Yeah, of course, those have been really special, just cheering everyone on. For the first time, I got to go out to gymnastics. I got to watch Simone Biles win another gold medal, and I got to bring my daughter. And that was just a highlight for me, you know, watching these games through her eyes. It's been so incredibly special and fun. And so we've really enjoyed that.
Allison Felix, we can't thank you enough for taking the time to chat with us. Really appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you for having me.
And we have much more coverage of the Olympics online, including a story about how the number of men and women competing at this year's games is nearly equal for the first time in history. But advocates say more still needs to be done to level the playing field. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.